After a delay of several weeks, we are going to talk about the April sermon for our theme this year, which has been talking about how the fields outside of our context here amongst us in this congregation, the fields out there are white for harvest, as they always have been. And remember, we started our study in January talking about how Jesus said that many, many years ago in the Gospel of John, right after he had talked with the Samaritan woman at the well there in Sychar, and his disciples had come back from going into town to buy bread, and here he is talking with this random woman who's not even a Jewess. And so he explains to them in the course of that awkward conversation why he's doing what he's doing there. As she runs into town to go get everybody to come back to him, he looks up and he says, "Look, guys, the fields are white. We can reach people like Samaritans." And eventually, of course, he's going to send his guys out into the entire world to bring everybody from all the nations who's interested in him to God. And so that just sets up everything else that we're going to talk about this year. In February, we talked about the different kinds of roles that God has chosen for teaching lost people. You know, evangelism is not just about what the teacher does, although obviously that is one of the roles. And so we did talk about Paul in his work in the Thessalonican church and how he said that he taught them. He said, "I was like a nursing mother to you. I was like a father to you. I was with you. I was helping you in every possible way to come away from idols to the living God." A lot of powerful things there. And now in April, we're going to talk about Matthew. We're going to talk about being a host. We're going to talk about somebody opening up their personal space and providing a context for a teacher to come in and connect with people that need the gospel of Jesus. I think it's important because this really hits at one of the defining aspects of God's character. God is, by his very nature, a very open God. You know, when you look at Luke 15, the parable of what we often call the prodigal son, God portrays himself as a father who is eagerly watching the road, waiting for the lost son to get a clue and to finally hit the road back home. And when he does, he runs out and meets him. In the prophet Isaiah, in a couple of different places, God portrays himself as the light to the nations. And Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, picks up that theme and says, "Look, guys, you as my people, because I am the light, you are to be the light of the world. You are to be the city that is set up there on a hill that's really obvious and noticeable to all the weary travelers around who need a place to stay for the night, spiritually speaking. Yeah, you are to be the one to help, to be open, to be welcoming, because I and my Father and the Spirit, the whole thing we've been doing this entire time in human history is welcoming sinners into our embrace." And so that's what he wants us to do. That's what you see Matthew doing. Matthew's not just a guy who gets taught and becomes a disciple and then sits on his haunches. He's a guy who tries to help other people to get the same thing that he's got himself. So I think it's going to be a really neat study. But what I want to do just for a minute is talk about how hospitality, even in the Old Testament, before we even crack open the book of Matthew and look at what happens there, hospitality is always God's context for bringing blessings to people who need it. You think about what happens in Genesis 18 with Abraham and the three guys that show up at his tent door, who actually turn out to be angels. And that's why Hebrews says, "Don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers, because some people have entertained angels and not even known it." That's what happens to this guy. You know, he knows he's about 100 years old, roughly, and he's been waiting 25 years for God to fulfill his promise to bless him and his wife with kids. And so Ishmael, eventually, you know, they try to do the Hagar thing, and that turns into a complete dead end. And so by this point in Abraham's life, he knows
Because God has specifically told him, you're going to have that son through your wife, Sarah. It's going to be Sarah. It's not going to be anybody else. So he knows it's going to happen that way, but he doesn't know the timing. He's been waiting decades for this. But it's at this particular moment of his life, when he is sharing the blessings of his home and his flocks and his milk with these three visitors, it's in that setting of him blessing the angels that God says, I'm going to bless you in this kind of way. About this time next year, your wife is going to have a son. A son that we've been talking about this whole time. And not only that, when you can go to 2 Kings chapter 4, and you can think about what happens with Elisha and the Shunammite family. Shunem was not a major city in Israel, but the prophet Elisha would pass through Shunem all the time as he's making his circuits or he's going to different places he wants to go, teach and do prophet work, whatever that work entailed. And there's a rich woman there with a husband, but it really focuses on the woman. She looks at the situation and she says to her husband, you know what? He's here all the time. What we could do is we could build an extra room onto our house and we could make, you know, a table and a chair and set an oil lamp there, give him a bed for the night, you know, so that he's always got a place to go whenever he's passing through here. Husband's like, okay, we'll do that. And one day Elisha is sitting in his room that they made just for him. And he calls in the woman and he says, you know what? You've done so much for me. What can I do for you? Can I give, you know, you a word with the king? You know, can I talk to some important person for you? And she says, I mean, no, I don't really need anything. I live amongst my own people. Thank you, but no thank you. But Elijah keeps going, no, we got to do something for you. So finally, Gehazi, his servant, pipes up and says, well, she doesn't have a son and her husband's old. Does that sound familiar? It's like this all over again. And so Elisha says, okay, well, about this time next year, you're going to have a son. And so in the very context of, I'm going to bless you with my open home and my food and a bed, you know, it's that blessing comes back. And God chooses to use that as a way to bless that person. And that also happens when you get to the New Testament and you open up the book of Acts. It's so neat to me that right after thousands of people obey the gospel, they're baptized, we're told a little bit into what happens right after that. You look at the very end of Acts 2, they are sharing everything with each other. In fact, you know, they have all things in common with each other. They're listening to the apostles' teaching. They're breaking bread together. They're going to the temple. But it also says at the end of Acts 2, they're in homes together. They're opening up their personal spaces to be with each other. And that is the context for the very last phrase of Acts 2, which says, the Lord added to their number day by day those who are being saved. Do you think it's any accident that that phrase just gets thrown in there at the very last minute? No, there people are being added to the Lord because this is going on, this hospitality business, this welcome into my life so that you can learn about the Lord kind of business. So this is what we're talking about here when we get to Matthew. This is what we got to think about when it comes to the homes that we have. Do we just look at our homes as the place where we kind of sequester ourselves away from the world, get some personal time? Or, you know, in COVID days, my home is my workplace. You know, it's a place where I just buckle down and do what I need to do. Or, you know, my home is for me. Well, you know, it's the shelter from, you know, the elements. It's all of those things. But our homes in the Bible are meant to be used as kingdom tools to accomplish the Lord's work, in addition to all the things that they do for us. Really powerful things can happen with that. So I want to look at Matthew chapter 9 now with you. Go with me in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 9. We're going to look at this apostle Matthew here.
this account is in other Gospels too, but I kind of like the idea of going to Matthew's Gospel for Matthew to tell us how Jesus called him and what that looked like. So that's why we're in this Gospel today. So Matthew chapter 9, Matthew's going to talk about the beginning of his relationship with Jesus and what happened with that. So Matthew chapter 9, verse 9, look at this with me. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at a tax booth, and he said to them, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Okay, so a couple of things to notice about this story, this account here. First of all, look at how Matthew came to the Lord. He came in the exact same way that the other apostles came to the Lord. You notice how Jesus has already called the fishermen by this point. Peter, Andrew, James, and John. You know, he has approached them on the seacoast, and he said, "Follow me." Which is, of course, interesting because usually in this time, Jewish rabbis didn't do recruiting. It's not like a college or a university or a business place. You waited for people to come to you. But Jesus goes out and approaches people. And who does he approach? He approaches the lowly people on the shore. But what he does with Matthew is the same kind of phrase. "You come, you follow me." And I think by this time, Matthew's got a pretty good idea of who Jesus is. By this point in the gospel, Jesus' fame is beginning to spread. His message, his miracles, people are, especially over in Galilee, people are beginning to know about this stuff. And so he responds in the same way that the fishermen did back in chapter 4. What they do is they drop their nets, they leave the dad in the boats, and they hit the trail with Jesus wherever he's going. Matthew does the same thing. Did you notice how Jesus doesn't knock on Matthew's door when he's sitting on his couch, eating bonbons or something? Matthew is in the middle of doing work, just like the fishermen, when he approaches them, are in the middle of doing work. It's almost like Jesus is saying, "You know what you thought you were going to be doing with the rest of your life? Well, actually, you're going to drop that, and you're going to devote yourself to an entirely different mission. And so, you might do some fishing later on, but that's not going to be your life's work. You might do some tax collecting later on, in an honest way, but that's not going to be your life's work. I'm going to become your identity and your mission and your work." But unlike the fishermen that Jesus calls, this guy is anathema to the rest of his culture and society. And so if Jesus is trying to be socially acceptable and slick in his message and in his followers that kind of provide the backdrop of his message, he's done a really bad job of that. And we'll talk about that. I think most of us are familiar with how Jews looked at tax collectors, but I'm going to have a few more things to say about that as we get into this. But look what happens after Matthew decides to follow, after he gets the invitation. He goes and he throws a party. Now, in this gospel account, it doesn't specifically say that it's Matthew's house. Did you notice that? It just says they were reclining in the house. So whose house? Well, Luke 5 tells us this really was Matthew's house. He opened this up and he has this party, and he... not surprisingly, he invites a whole bunch of people that are just like him. Because those are the people that would give him the time of day. Those are his friends, the tax collectors and sinners. These are not the kind of people that would have been welcomed with open arms at the synagogue. He would have been just showing up at, Saturday worship. "Here I am." This is not those people. They were regarded as oppressors. not just immoral people that don't have their ducks in a row, broke the law of Moses, ignored traditions. These are terrible people in the eyes of the culture because they put their finger on the burden of fellow Jews. There were a lot of taxes that the first century Jews had to pay. I know we are just starting to come out of tax season ourselves, right? And so this is kind of fresh on all of our minds. And I just want us to realize how much they had to pay and how much these tax collectors collected. I mean, there was a Jewish tax that the Jews themselves collected from each other that went to the treasury at the temple. But that was a pretty light tax. Maybe a little bit of tax on like a tithe on your crops that went to the priests and the Levites. But then you had this huge long list of Roman taxes that you had to pay. There was a huge tax on your crops, and it was paid by whoever worked the land. Regardless of whether you owned the land that you worked or not, you had to pay a tax on those crops. And that was assessed by the tax collector. He went to your land, and he determined, you know, how much you were able to yield from that land, and tax that accordingly. There was a tax based on the number of people who lived in a district. There was a tax on the transportation of goods, like slaves and animals. And that tax also covered if you wanted to rent a space in a marketplace, if you had a bunch of pottery you wanted to sell, there's a huge tax on that. If you crossed over certain roads and bridges, tolls, you know, we have tolls too today too. Jenny and I just crossed the George Washington Bridge in Manhattan, and we sure paid a toll for that. Well, they had tolls like that in those days, too. There's an inheritance tax, there's a sales tax, there's a business license fee, and on top of all of those taxes, the people who collected them were often unscrupulous people. In fact, I don't know, I only read this in one source, so take it with a grain of salt. But according to one person's estimation, 50 to 80% of personal income in the first century went to taxes. Next time you're tempted to complain about how much you have to pay to Uncle Sam and the United States Treasury and mass taxes and whatever, you think about that. 50 to 80%. So you can imagine why the Pharisees and other people would look into Matthew's courtyard at that feast and be really shocked by that. Because just imagine, you're one of these Jewish people living in this land, and every year, this really well-dressed fellow Jew shows up with kind of a smirk on his face and says, "It's time to pony up." You've got nothing you can say about that. You can't write your congressman, because there are no congressmen to write! You know, and you look over at a temple that's being, you know, constructed, or a new palace that one of the Herods is building, and you say, "Yep, that's where my money went." And you look over at Zacchaeus' house or Matthew's house, and you pass by and you say, "Yep, that's where my money went. My kids and my wife barely have enough to eat, while these pigs live like kings." Put yourself in their shoes and imagine the hostility, the animosity, the hatred that can so easily crop up if you're living in that kind of situation. You're the bottom of the barrel while you look at these people who are living high on the hog off of money that you scraped and sweated almost to death to accumulate and make. And it all goes to these people, or at least a big chunk of it does. So, you can imagine the shock. You can imagine what they're feeling. I think it's easy to just poke at the Pharisees and those like them, but step into their shoes and feel that discomfort. But Jesus doesn't feel uncomfortable. He's going to go in there. He's going to sit at that table in front of everybody else who's passing by looking at this. And he's going to talk to these people. So Matthew is opening up his home, and because of that, Jesus is able to pursue his friends. Matthew's hospitality, what it did was, it really helped to illuminate, it helped to show and demonstrate what Jesus' work was all about. You know, sometimes Jesus didn't bother to correct people's misimpressions of him. You ever notice that? Like, especially when you get to the cross and you get to the trials, and people are saying all kinds of things about him. You know, maybe he would say a few things, but mostly he was just silent.
Did you notice what happens here? The Pharisees don't even approach Jesus. They just talk to his guys. You know, how come you teach Jesus? He hears that, and he goes over and approaches them. Like, he comes out to the gate of the courtyard and says, okay, guys, let me tell you why I'm here sitting at this table. I just think that's a little interesting. When it came to the mission of his work, sometimes in his ministry, he would go, okay, we are going to clarify this. You know, when it comes to the cross, you can say whatever you're going to say about me, and I'm not going to put up a fight. But when it comes to what I am doing here on earth, you need to understand this. I've come because I'm a doctor. And what do doctors do? They hang out with sick people on a regular basis, and they help heal their bodies, and they help them however they can.
And that's what I'm doing too. I think this situation shows a side of Jesus that people didn't get to see when he's preaching to a crowd of thousands of people. He can go up on the mountain, he can preach a sermon on the mount, but it's really in this kind of setting where people really see what the heart of Jesus is all about. You know, he can talk about mercy. He can talk about, blessed are those who are merciful, for they shall receive mercy. He can talk about, if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than other people? He can talk about all those things. But it's in Matthew's house, sitting at Matthew's table, that people really see what that looks like. And I think that's so neat. His dinner table was a perfect place for Jesus to demonstrate what he meant by everything that he taught. So, let's get to applications here. That's the text in Matthew 9. I want to talk about for a few minutes before we eat the supper together why we need Matthews here in this congregation. People providing a host setting for the teacher to come in. I think for one thing, Matthews provide a comfortable environment for Christians to connect with other people. Think about, again, the people that Jesus is eating with here. They're not used to respectable people giving them the time of day. You get it? Because they're tax collectors and sinners. They're not people who expected to spend a bunch of personal time with Jesus. But because they're invited in, because they've got this connection here with Matthew, Jesus is able to talk with them in a really helpful, kind of personal way. And so, as a preface for saying what I'm about to say, I want to say this. I think amongst Christians, sometimes church buildings get a bad rap. You know, we talk about how we need to be doing stuff outside of what we do inside these walls, and that's true. But I think it's such a blessing to be able to have a space like this that we can control, that we don't pay rent to, that we can do what we want to do with any time we want to do with it. That is a blessing of a building like this that some congregations do not have at all. But for various reasons, a space like this in a regular worship service is sometimes just not the most comfortable environment for outsiders to connect to for a lot of reasons. Because I think, you know, many of us that are here and are here every Sunday and Wednesday, we don't think anything of coming into this building. We know most of the people that are here, right? We know that there's going to be some songs and some Lord's Supper. We know that there's going to be sermons and classes. We've been in those a lot. We know what that all looks like. We're very comfortable here, those of us who are members of this local congregation. But put yourself in the shoes of a visitor who's never been to a church like this before. Do you know any of the people here? Do you know what anything about the service is going to be about? You know, there's so many question marks. It takes a lot of courage to walk through those doors. and to sit on a pew not knowing what this is going to happen exactly. That's something that I think we don't stop to think about. But if you are going into a home, think about how less intimidating that is. Think about how that provides an open setting for you to connect with somebody in a very informal way. You know, when I first met the Fennessy family, it wasn't here. It was actually, I think, at Robert and Holly's house. I think they were hosting a singing in their home, and Sandy Hayes comes up to me and says, "You gotta meet these people over here," and, with her, you know, enthusiastic way. And I did, and I connected, and I wasn't the only one that got to connect with them that night, and so much good and so many blessings came from that experience. You know, part of the theory behind the family group meetings is that not only do we get a chance to rub elbows with each other, get to know each other better, but that provides a pretty natural setting. If there's a visitor amongst us and you're having a family group meeting that day, it's pretty good opportunity to grab that visitor and say, "Hey, we're doing this thing at this house. Why don't you come and eat with us and spend time with us there?" Open homes are a setting for open hearts and open teaching and lots of open things. So they provide a comfortable environment for Christians to connect with others, but even more specifically than that, they provide an intimate setting for Bible study. I think the sermons that we do here and the public Bible classes that we do here are a blessing. I'm glad that we do them. That needs to be done, I think. But I think, you know, like most American churches, you know, we have very strict parameters about what we do here. And, you know, our Bible classes begin at 9 o'clock on the dot. They end at 9:45 on the dot, so that we can go into this, so that we can go into that and that. And I'm not trying to say there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but there's only so much that we can do together in a public Bible class. And if you're a visitor coming in off the streets, how likely is it that you're going to, in a whole crowd of people you don't know, like raise your hand and try to insert yourself into the back and forth discussion that we have here? Some of us members who've been a part of this group for a very long time don't feel exactly comfortable, you know, adding our voice to a Bible class here. So there's lots of things to think about with that. That kind of goes away to some extent when you go into a home and you sit at a kitchen table instead of everybody here together in pews. Because unlike here, we can go over 45 minutes and that's all right. We can take our time. If there's a big discussion that needs to happen, we can have the openness in that kind of way to deal with questions or comments that need to be asked or answered. And so maybe you're not going to be the teacher to lead a class. Maybe that's not your role in God's family, but you could be at Matthew and open up your space so that a teacher could come in and connect. So many of the people that I've studied with since I've been a part of this church have not been people who have come to this building. Or if they have, they came once or twice. Most of the time, I'm studying with people over kitchen tables, either mine or in some cases some of yours. The best studies I've had have been either at the Dugas' house or mine or somebody else's. It's just such a blessing. And you don't have to have a big and fancy place in order to do that. Did you notice in the text here, in fact, there is nothing said in Matthew 9 about the kind of house Matthew had? He probably had a big, huge house. He's probably rich. But the text doesn't say anything about that because that's not the point. The point was he had a table. The point was he had a house and he gave what he had so that Jesus could come in and connect with these people in the way that he did. So if you've got a little apartment or you've got a mansion, you can use that for the glory of God. Come back to the glory of God. This is what this is all about. And something else about this. We need Matthew's because they demonstrate the same welcome that God has given all of us. At one time, all of us who are now Christians were strangers to God. We didn't know Him, didn't really know anything about what He was about, what His gospel message was. And in fact, in Ephesians 2, Paul just really draws that out to say, you used to be dead, you used to be children of wrath, you used to be strangers to the covenant of promise. You weren't like the Jews. But now, in Jesus Christ, those who've been far off have been brought near by the blood of Jesus. He's welcomed all of us into the family of Abraham. And today, like He does every week, He welcomes us to His table. He welcomes us to eat with Him. Just like the 12, right before the cross, sat at a table and ate with Him in order to think about not just the Passover that the Jews would celebrate every year, but now the new Passover. Well, the sin and the death that Jesus leads us out of, just like the Israelites were led out of their slavery in Egypt. He's going to welcome all of us to live in His house someday. So hospitality isn't a random command. It's not an arbitrary example that you see Abraham and the Shunammite woman and people doing in the first century. Godly families do that in Scripture in order to show who God is. Because God has done this with us. And He has blessed us innumerably through the body and the blood of His own Son. And when we become like Matthew, and we open up the parts of our lives where we feel comfortable to people who might not feel very comfortable with their lives, we show the character and the heart of God. So God wants Matthews in churches to share their homes because He has shared Himself, quite literally, with all of us. And that's going to take us into thinking about supper that we're about to partake of together.